Last week, we looked at the church and the empire and the conflict that develops between Christianity as it gains momentum, as it converts more and more people, and then why the Roman Empire really had a conflict with Christianity. What were the reasons behind it? What forms did it take? What shape did it take? And we're going to start by going back to the end of that and looking again at Diocletian and then taking this all the way up through the Council of Chalcedon. So we won't probably make it to 600 AD, although a lot of the implications of Chalcedon continue for a number of years. And the issues that are at stake at Chalcedon don't go away. So Diocletian is the Roman Empire emperor who's going to end the period of the Baric emperors. This is the period where we have about 25 emperors in 40 years. All of them are called Baric emperors because they're all army officers. Diocletian is no different. He's a soldier from Illyria. That's the area directly east of Italy in the Balkans. He's a great soldier. He's a commander of cavalry, and on a campaign to the east, the emperor Carus is killed by lightning. Now, this is a very odd thing. Probably that's just later historical writing, meaning that Diocletian killed him. Numerian, Carus' son, dies in his litter from an eye infection, probably also murdered by Diocletian. And Diocletian quickly seizes power by killing anyone else that would have been around that could have offered any sort of opposition to him, including Carus' other son. And the problems of the empire, he realizes, are many. And to solve this, he institutes a new form of government called the Tetrarchy, which is rule by four. And this is going to be, if you can go to the next slide, here's a map of the Tetrarchy, and you can see the purple section over here in Asia and Turkey and Egypt and Syria is going to be the area directly controlled by Diocletian. This would be the area with the most problems at this time. Rome would have been threatened by the Persians, who are further to the east, and so they would have been the major source of Roman opposition outside the empire at this time. And then you have other people. Maximian is going to be the other Augustus or top-level emperor. And then you have two Caesari, which one of them is going to be Galerius, who's the pagan, who helps Diocletian institute the great persecution. And the other one is going to be Constantius Chlorus, who is going to reign in France and Britain. And so we have this divided form of government. And during the persecution, Maximian and Constantius don't really persecute the Christians. The West has fewer Christians. Christianity was less of a problem in the western part of the empire. Just because there were less of them, so they upset the population less. But Constantius pulls down a couple of churches, doesn't really kill anyone. The major persecutions take place in the east, and also in North Africa around Carthage, or there are a lot of problems, and in Rome too. But it's not quite as bad in the area of Constantius' court, probably because Constantius' wife is a Christian. So he's not going to be too keen on persecuting the religion of his wife. All right, let's see. Next slide. All right, so the rise of Constantine. Constantine is going to be the son of Constantius Chlorus. And Constantius Chlorus is going to die, probably of leukemia. His name Chlorus means the pale. So he probably was suffering from some sort of blood disorder. He dies in York, which would have been far north in England. And Constantine is going to be proclaimed the emperor by his father's troops. This is not typical, and this was not the way that Diocletian had intended it to be. Diocletian had intended the Augusti to appoint a new Caesari. But since the Augusti died, his troops proclaimed Constantine to be emperor. They'd have done this in a traditional fashion by raising him up on their shields over and over again. And we have a problem, because now Constantine kind of is leading a rebellion inside the empire. All right, so we have a period of civil war that develops, and he's not the only one who is rebelling. Maximian's son, Maxentius, to make it very complicated, is also rebelling, and he breaks away and forms another empire around the city of Rome. He endears himself to the people by remitting all taxes, but there's going to be this period of civil war, so you have about five or six different emperors going on at this time. And Constantine is going to emerge as the victor. And this is going to be against all odds. Constantine is not going to be the most powerful. His army is not going to be the largest. He's going to invade Italy. Italy has been invaded a number of times by the other emperors, and it all turned out badly for everyone except for Constantine. Constantine's timing was good because the people in Rome by this point had become tired of Maxentius. And so Maxentius, who had before used bribes to pay off his enemies' armies, now is not able to do that. One, he's run out of money, and two, the people of Rome, he's worried that if the army makes it all the way to the walls of Rome, the people might kill him and throw him out. So he leads an army outside of Rome, and at a place called Sox Arubra, which means just red rocks in Latin, they're going to have a battle. And it's also near a bridge that's going to be called the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. And there's the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. Here's a very famous painting. This is in the Palace of the Popes in Rome. This is in one of, I think this is in Julius II's bedroom. So they fight at this battle, and before the battle, there's the famous conversion of Constantine that takes place. Constantine looks up in the sky, supposedly has a dream, and in the sky there's the sun. And above the sun there's a cross or some Christian symbol. We don't really know exactly if it was the cross. He's not very clear. It could have been the Cairo symbol, which would have been the two Greek letters imposed on each other, which would have been the first two letters of Christ's name. Anyway, he hears in his dream the Latin phrase, in hoc signu vinces, which means in this sign, conquer. So he has his soldiers paint the sign, whether it's a cross or a Cairo, on their shield, and goes out when with his smaller army defeats Maxentius. Maxentius tries to cross. You can see the Milvian Bridge over here. If you go to Rome, the Milvian Bridge is very close to Rome. It's just a few miles outside the city. The Milvian Bridge is very, very small. If you think about tens of thousands of people trying to get across it very quickly, it wouldn't really work. So Maxentius had very wisely built a pontoon bridge next to the Milvian Bridge. Unfortunately, his soldiers, in their haste to get across, had pulled out all the pins to keep Constantine's soldiers from getting back across. So the only thing that was left was the Milvian Bridge. And most sources agree that Maxentius was tossed off the Milvian Bridge in the chaos and drowned in the river. Anyway, his body was found in the river. And Constantine becomes the sole emperor of the West. Now, after this, let's see. We can just wait for that one, but it's okay. After this, Constantine and the Eastern Emperor at the time, a guy by the name of Licinius, are going to get together and they're going to issue an Edict of Toleration. This is the famous Edict of Milan. This takes place in 313 A.D. And this is not going to recognize Christianity as an official religion. All it's going to do is say that all religions, no matter what they are tolerated. And this is going to be specifically, obviously, addressed to Christianity, since Christianity was really the only religion at the time that the Romans were persecuting. But this is going to be this. So you have the Eastern and Western emperors together agreeing that we're going to tolerate Christianity. Unfortunately, this doesn't last. Next slide. Constantine favors Christianity more and more as he gives money to the church, as he gives power and authority to the leaders of the church. Licinius in the East, where Christianity is the most numerous, begins fearing that the Christians inside his territory are kind of acting as like a fifth column, kind of helping Constantine, feeding him information. He's nervous. Constantine, he's worried about his position in the East. And so he begins persecuting the Christians again in 317 to about 324. And this really is like a big shock to a lot of Christians, because they had kind of felt like all this was over. And here's another Roman emperor who's persecuting the church again. Now, this just gives Constantine the excuse that he's looking for to invade the eastern part of the empire. And at the Battle of Adrianople, there's a lot of battles fought at Adrianople, by the way, but this is the one in 324. He defeats Licinius and really gains control of all the eastern part of the empire. Licinius surrenders to Constantine later. Constantine is nice to him at first, allows him to live, but then a plot's uncovered and Licinius is executed. All right. So, but you have to understand at this point that Christianity is still not anywhere close to a majority of the population. It's still a relatively small population-wise. Now, it's going to start growing very quickly once imperial favor and patronage starts being poured into it. But at this point, we can say that Christianity probably accounts for about 10 to 15% of the population. That's it. So paganism is by no way dead. Now, but what's happening, though, is intellectually paganism is becoming inferior to Christianity. Christian ideas, Christian explanations philosophically are more thoughtful and better reasoned. And really the only thing that's left to paganism is this idea of tradition. And so, especially in the East, paganism is going to begin to die out. Now, not in Rome. Rome is probably the area where paganism holds on the most because there's the most tradition there. But it begins to die out. Now, before it can completely die out, though, there's one last pagan emperor that we need to talk about. And this is going to be Julian the Apostate. Julian the Apostate is the grand nephew of Constantine. And what happens when Constantine dies in 337 A.D., he appoints a new tetrarchy. That's kind of his solution, once again, is that we're going to have a new tetrarchy. You have my three sons, I have my nephew. They're going to be the guys who divide up the empire again, and we're going to go back to the way it was before, because no one's as good as me and able to control all the empire at once. So we're going to divide it up between his three sons and his nephew. Now, the sons and the army refuse this, and what ends up happening is the sons murder all the rest of their family, all the male relatives that aren't in their immediate family, except for two grandnephews of Constantine, Julian and his brother Gallus. And they're children, and so they're spared and just sent off to live in remote areas and just be forgotten, basically. But what ends up happening is that the brothers end up fighting amongst themselves, two of them do, and then another one's overwhelmed by a rebel. And so basically what you have is you have one son of Constantine, Constantius, is the only one left, and he has no children. And the only person that's left to carry on the throne after him is Julian. But what's happened between this time is that Julian has rejected Christianity. He's been baptized in the church, he becomes a reader in the church, so this would be just a position of he would read the scriptures in the service. But he secretly converts to paganism. He gets inducted into the cult of Isis and the cult of Mithras, and he becomes a very, very devout pagan. And as soon as his uncle dies, he comes out, right? He's seeking to reestablish paganism as a viable religion. And he does this in a couple of ways. He does this by trying to remodel pagan ideas and pagan practices on the church. Paganism involves catechisms now. High priests function like bishops. And he tries to organize the pagans to do good works like the Christians. This is one of his big things about the Christians. He's like, you know, they take care of the poor. They take care of everyone's poor. Why don't we do this? He needs to organize this against them. He also seeks to turn Christian teaching against them by writing a very famous book called Against the Galileans, in which he uses his knowledge of Christianity as a former Christian to kind of poke at weak points, or what he perceives to be weak points in Christian doctrine and ideas. And this is going to go on. Christian apologists are going to be writing responses to his work for hundreds of years. And then the final way he tries to counteract Christianity is he finds in the Bible this very specific reference that the temple isn't going to be rebuilt again. And so he's going to rebuild the temple. Unfortunately, an earthquake stops that, from his point of view, unfortunately. An earthquake stops that. And in a campaign in the East, he is killed in battle. He only reigns for about 2 or 3 years. And his famous last words, which are attributed only a couple of hundred years after his death, so we have no way of knowing whether these are true or not, is, "Thou hast conquered, O Galilean." So this is the end of paganism. After this, good Christian emperor is appointed, not in the family of Constantine, and things go on. But what we have developing in the church, especially after Julian, is the church and the Roman state become joined together. And this happens right away from the beginning with Constantine. And there's going to be a price to be paid for this. If we can go to the next slide. Now, there are benefits, make no mistake, right? Hundreds, thousands of Christians were being persecuted. Suddenly they're not. Christians being martyred all over the empire, killed. It's a good thing that they're not anymore. But there are benefits, right? The church receives the favored status that used to be conferred to paganism. So the church becomes a replacement in many people's eyes for old Roman civil and social pride. So you're going to start seeing people taking pride in the church and kind of equating the loyalty that they used to have to the Roman emperors to the church. And this is going to be one reason why, when the Roman Empire falls, eventually, especially in the West, that the church is able to hold on to so much of the structure of the Roman Empire and so much of the culture of the Roman Empire is because a lot of that allegiance that had been transferred and given to the empire has now been given to the church. So as the empire falls apart, people are still upset, but people like Augustus, and we'll talk about this next week, really offer a way for them to understand that. Another good thing that comes out of it is that church art and architecture really starts to proliferate. And the church is going to dominate late ancient culture artistically and architecturally, basically because they're going to be the ones with the most money. As Constantine funnels and the later emperors funnel money into the church is able to build great and beautiful churches, and they're going to adopt the Roman form. This is a picture of a basilica. So this would have been a typical Roman meeting house type of thing that the church then would have taken and converted into a church, architecturally speaking. So you'd have a long aisle that led to a kind of a half dome, and there would have been pillars on the side. And this would have been the typical church in the early church. And also the growth of Christian festivals and holy places, kind of to replace pagan festivals and holy sites. You have the church kind of stepping in and filling that. So we have evidence, even before the time of Constantine, we have shrines for Peter and Paul, three of them in Rome, and a number of other ones. But once Constantine comes to power, this is going to expand greatly. So you have Constantine's mother, especially, goes to the Holy Land and brings, like, starts going on pilgrimages to all the holy sites in Jerusalem and everything, unearths the true cross and brings it back with her to Rome and then to Constantinople and things like this. So this all kind of begins, especially on a larger scale, with the time of Constantine. More benefits that take place. Oh, Christianity eventually is going to be the official religion. This is going to be Theodosius I. This is going to be in 381. So you can see it takes another 50 years, well, over 50 years, almost 70 years, after the time of Constantine, after the Edict of Milan, for Christianity to actually become the official religion. And even then, paganism is still going to be tolerated. It's not going to be until the reign of Julian and Theodora that you really see Christianity start to persecute what's left of paganism. Theodosius's tutor for his son is going to be a famous pagan. So we don't have a lot of paganism being, we still have paganism being tolerated. It just becomes the official religion. And then the copying of the scriptures. Constantine commissions 50 monumental copies of the scriptures. And we probably still have two of these left. The oldest two complete copies of scripture probably date from this time period. And the 50 copies of the scriptures, just to give you an idea of how big these things were, would have been, would have probably required the slaughter of 5,000 cows to make the vellum to produce these 50, just 50 Bibles, 5,000 cows. And this is one reason, it's because vellum lasts for so long. Obviously, we still have copies, the original copies of at least two of these scriptures with us. And this is a picture of one of them. This is the Codex Vaticanus, which comes from the Vatican, and we have one more. Now, there are problems with this as well. We can go to the next slide, look at the problems. And there are a lot of them, all right? State control and influence over the church begins. Now, this isn't a new relationship, all right? In the conflict with Paul of Samosata in Antioch, he's a monarchian heretic who becomes bishop of Antioch. The church, to get rid of him, actually in one of the periods of peace before Constantine, appeals to the Roman emperor and says, look, we've deposed this guy, make him give us our church back. And the emperor steps in and decides in the favor of the church and kicks Paul out. But this is in 272. This is 30, 40 years before Constantine offers his edict of toleration. So we're going to have a new relationship with state control over the church, or influence over it anyway, able to impose. Now, this is going to involve a lot of ways. Imperial influence in the appointment and removal of church officials is going to become more and more common. As more and more power is given to church officials, the empire, and the emperor in particular, is going to take more and more interest in who is appointed to it. And then you're going to see this in a number of ways. You have a number of officials that are going to be deposed by the will of the emperor for nothing more than they just upset the emperor, or the empress, more likely. And so they're gotten rid of. Now, the concentration of power in the great sees of the church, the great centers of ecumenical power, is going to start developing at this time as more and more authority is given to them by the emperor. They're going to start gaining more and more power. And then we finally have the equation of Christian and Orthodox with a good citizen, kind of the same thing that happened before the Edict of Milan with paganism. If you are pagan, if you sacrifice to the emperors, you are a good Roman citizen. Now that's going to become the case with Christians and Orthodox Christians. So if you're a heretic or you're not a Christian, do you really support the state? Are you an enemy? Are you a rebel? And so you're going to start seeing persecution of heretics and pagans. This is going to develop in isolated instances. Other problems. The church gains political and economic importance. Now, this is going to lead to a lot of problems. It's going to lead to conflict over the election to bishops' offices. Right? Before this, if you were the bishop, you were the first person in a persecution that was going to be singled out and taken away and killed. That doesn't make the office necessarily very appealing to a lot of people. If you know, at any point, if persecution breaks out, my neck is the first one that's going to be chopped. Right? But as that idea and the threat of martyrdom decreases, and as more and more power and wealth is given to people in authority within the church, these offices become very, very desirable. You have one pagan even says, you know, if they would make me bishop of Rome, I'd become a Christian. So one of the famous pagan satirists who criticizes the church and everything at this time says, you know, if they would want to make me bishop of Rome, I'll be a Christian, sure. That looks like a nice position. So church officials are granted imperial favors like freedom from taxation. So if you're a church official, if you're a priest, no taxes. Bishops and other leaders gain imperial titles. Things like your holiness, most exalted one, and things like this, which would have been just like titles that would have been put in front of names in Latin. But they're given these titles and they continue to the day. I mean, we have titles like this given to the Pope and different things like this that are continued. Bishops and church leaders gain political power and the ability to influence governmental decisions. Now, this can be both good and bad. To give you an example, we'll talk about the Bishop of Milan, a guy by the name of Ambrose. We won't get to talk about him a lot. We'll talk about him a little bit more next week. But Ambrose uses his authority and power to influence political decisions in two ways. One, some Christians had torn down and burned a Jewish synagogue, and the emperor wanted to make them pay for it. And Ambrose told the emperor, no, you can't do that. Christians shouldn't have to pay Jews for anything. So the emperor says, okay, whatever. And the other one, so not a good idea of church influence over politics, but another one is the same emperor had massacred a number of his citizens in the city of Thessalonica because they had rioted and killed one of his army officers. So he had thousands of them massacred. And Ambrose refused to let the Roman emperor come into church or take communion until he had performed public penance for his action. So there we see even the bishop being able to deny the sacrament to the emperor and to force him to repent for actions that he thought were wrong. That's a good example of church influence. Over. Next slide. Another problem that this is going to cause, and this might not seem like a problem right away, but it's going to create a massive influx of converts. Church and governmental favor is going to create a massive influx of converts. It's going to lead to three major problems. Laxity within the church, syncretism with old pagan beliefs, and the development of new heresies that kind of form out of this half-converted, synchronistic types of mentalities that go on. You can see the growth. In 150 AD, the estimated population was probably about 1 million Christians in the whole Roman Empire, about 2% of the population. By 300 AD, 150 years later, we have 6 million Christians, about 10% of the population. About the time that Constantine rises to power, we have about 10% of the population is Christian. This would give you reason to understand why Diocletian would really start persecuting them. If you have one out of every 10 people is a Christian and you feel like it's being subversive, that's a problem. But just 40 years or 30 years, 35 years after Constantine issues his Edict of Milan, we have about 34 million Christians. So we go from 10% to about 57% of the population in about 30 years. That is a massive influx of converts. And before, where Christianity had really been kind of guarded from a lot of just, oh yeah, I'll become a Christian type of things by, you know, you could be killed. That kind of puts a damper on just a flippant decision. And also, the Christian period to become a Christian, like if you wanted to become a Christian, it took about a year. Training and praying and fasting and doing all these things. They were very, very diligent about making sure that you were being very committed to this. Now, that just can't happen. When you have millions and millions and millions of people that are trying to come into the church, a lot of that just gets pushed to the side in favor of expediency. So that's going to cause a problem. So this is another part of this. Now, this is going to lead this massive influx of converts and this idea that the converts are just kind of half converted. And is Christianity losing its way as it becomes more and more mainstream? And as Christianity develops this kind of idea of everyone and it lacks, you know, the kind of rigor that had been there before is just not there anymore because there's so many people. This is going to lead to a new movement, which I'm not going to have a lot of time, so we're just going to run through this really quickly, is monasticism develops out of this. And this is really a kind of a silent rebellion is what A. Alston, he's an Anglican writer, talks about this. A silent rebellion against the increasingly close relationship of the church with the empire. I'm going to remove myself from society. It's kind of and it's not unlike the Donatists and the Novatians, right? If the church is becoming polluted with non-real Christians, what do I need to do? I need to remove myself from it. Kind of like the Donatists and the Novatians. That kind of mentality is there. Another cause is going to be, you can go to the next slide, yeah. The opportunity for martyrdom ceases. As the opportunity for martyrdom ceases, how do I know if I'm really a Christian or not? If I don't have this kind of big, in-my-face kind of decision to make for Christ, it's going to cost me a lot. How do I do that? Well, I self-martyr myself by going and removing myself from the world. I go out and live in the desert. I martyr myself. All right? And one of the other things that's going to influence this is going to be Gnosticism. Gnostic ideas that are still prevalent, especially in Syria and Egypt, where monasticism begins, this kind of ascetic, the physical world is evil type of mentality that Gnosticism really has a lot to say on, is going to be something that influences the early monastics. They wouldn't say this necessarily, but this idea and the ideas are out there and they're going to influence. And the church is going to highly value these people. Man, look how holy he is. He's going out living in the desert by himself. So Christians are going to look to these guys as being specially holy people. And even pagans are going to admire them because they're imitating the famous ascetic philosophers. People like Diogenes who lived in a trash heap and people like that. You have people that imitated Diogenes, a guy that would carry around a dead dog with him, monk, run around naked all the time. It was weird. He had some weird stuff. And that's one of the things that go on. You got some oddities. Here is Simon the Stylite who lived on top of a pillar for about 30 years. Just lived on top of a pillar. That was his monasticism. Going to get away from the world. I'm going to go live on top of my pillar. But it's okay as this humongous church is being built around me. That's okay. But I'm living on my pillar. So you have a lot of kind of oddities. You're going to have over 100 stylites eventually in the 500 or 600 years that stylites go on until Muslims come and wipe out this area as far as Christianity goes. But you're going to have about over 100 of these guys that just go and live on their towers. Next up. Now, there's two forms of monasticism. There are hermits who dwell alone in the desert. This is going to be true, especially in the East. The idea of hermits is going to be much more popular because, one, because the climate is a lot nicer. It's warm. You can go out and live by yourself. You don't have to live together. And they sought personal salvation by withdrawal from the world. An example of this is going to be St. Anthony the Great. Next slide. Another form of monasticism is going to be communities. So you're going to have a group of people who have a shared idea who are going to get together in St. Pachymius is going to be the guy who really starts this idea. He's an ex-soldier. So he's going to gather a bunch of guys. They're going to work hard, strict discipline, like soldiers should, and they're going to go and live together. And he founds a number of communities in Egypt. And he's going to be the guy who eventually people like Cassian, who's going to come to the West, and Basil of Caesarea, and eventually St. Benedict of Nursia are going to be the guys who kind of follow in his steps and are going to bring monasticism in the form that we know it, a group of guys living together, working hard, serving God, and praying and doing all the things that monks do. And we'll talk about more of that next week when we get to the medieval church. More problems that peace bring about. Persecution has benefits, right? Not a lot of heresy goes on during persecution because people are just worried about staying alive. They don't have the time to sit around and think up heresy or worry about it. And the church is very committed in the midst of persecution. It really weeds out those who aren't committed. So, during times of persecution, you have a very orthodox, by and large, very committed church. And this is going to be a problem because as soon as this ends, we get to heresies. Well, let's go to the next slide. We're going to start. Oh, more problems. Schisms obviously take place too. That's another problem of persecution. And that's going to really lead to, in a lot of ways, to complications anyway with the heresies that develop, especially in Alexandria where one of these schisms take place. Okay, next slide. All right. So the heresies that we're going to spend our time talking about today are going to be really, there's really four of them. There's Arianism and Apollinarianism, and then there's Nestorianism and Monophysitism, or Eutychianism, I think is how it's called. It's named after, we'll talk about the guy it's named after in a minute, although he's not really that important in the whole grand scheme of things, but he's the guy that gets named after. So there are earlier heresies before these four, and they're going to kind of fall into two camps. We're going to kind of fall into those that deny or lessen the full divinity of Christ. So adoptionism, monarchianism, Sabellianism, modalism are going to in ways kind of diminish the full divinity of Christ, either as, you know, a separate, fully God person, or just, you know, he wasn't God when he was born and then he got adopted into the Godhead. So you have all these. And then you're going to have those that deny the full humanity of Christ. And the first of these is going to be docetism. It just seemed like he was a person. He wasn't really a person. He just seemed like he was. So, and all kind of heresies are going to kind of fall in a lot of ways on one of those two sides. All right, especially the first two, Arianism and Apollinarianism. So next slide. And here's a little chart that kind of gives you. You have adoptionism on one side. It's kind of hard to see. The quality is not good. But greater emphasis on Christ's humanity and createdness. On the other side, greater emphasis on Christ's divinity. And you can see how these are going to kind of interchange. So green lines are influence. Red lines, if you can see the red lines, are kind of, they're going to deal with this in a kind of like kind of negative way. Like I'm going to argue against it. So Apollinarianism, which has a red line pointing to Neo-Arianism, is going to argue against Neo-Arianism. It's a reaction against it. Okay? Next slide. All right. So Alexandria. Alexandria is located in the Nile Delta down in Egypt. It's the second great city of the Roman Empire. In many ways, it's the first great city. It was probably the most populous city at this time period. And it was the city that had the most cosmopolitan atmosphere. You have over 1 million Jews. That's just Jews. The city probably had 4 to 5 million people in it. Pagans, Jews, Christians, and then you have all the weird Eastern religion and mystery cults that are involved. Mithraism, Zoroastrianism, Isis worship, all these different things. And it's going to be this big kind of pot where a lot of things kind of bubble and mix together. And this is where a lot of heresy comes from. And the guy who's going to start this is going to be Arius. Arius is a presbyter. If we can move to the next slide, this is an Arian timeline here. And he's going to be associated with the rigorous party that develops after the Diocletian persecution. You have the church in Alexandria splits, like the church in Rome does, like the church in Carthage does. You have a side that favors excluding the people who have lapsed, and you have a side that includes is readmitting them after a certain time period. And Alexandria was actually pretty tolerant as far as it goes. One of the more tolerant cities as far as letting them back in, and this leads to this. And so this is not going to put him necessarily on good terms with the bishop. But his major concern is making Christ acceptable to his contemporaries. His contemporaries in Alexandria who had all these different ideas about God, kind of Platonic ideas about God. God is completely other and unknowable. So Arius is going to say things like, the Son can't really know the Father. It's not possible. Because God is completely other. He can't know Him. He's created. He's created in time, right? There was a time when He was not. And Arius is going to be very, very good at composing little kind of like jingles that people are going to sing. So, you know, one of them goes like something like, I can serve it hot. There was a time when he was not, right? And during this synod that takes place in 318, that Alexander, who thankfully is named Alexander since he's the bishop of Alexandria, it kind of makes it less confusing anyway, calls together a local synod at this thing. The Arians get together, and in the middle of the synod, when they're trying to have a discussion about it, they just both break out in the song. Start chanting their little Arian rhymes, and the other bishops are like stopping up their ears and going crazy. So, you know, this is what goes on. Now, Arius is going to be condemned by Alexander, the bishop of Alexandria, and this local synod in 318. But it's not going to end because Arius, one, has a lot of support within the city itself, and he's very good at writing letters, and outside the city he gains a number of support. And the most famous of these are going to be the two Eusebiuses. So there's Eusebius of Caesarea, who's the historian, that if you want to read about early church history up to the time of Constantine, you should read him. And Eusebius of Nicomedia. At least these guys are on the same side, basically, so that helps us keep a little bit, keep them straight. So both the Eusebiuses, you should know, at least, even if they don't come out as full-blown Arians, although Eusebius of Nicomedia is, Eusebius of Caesarea definitely has Arian tendencies. He's a big fan of Origen, and Arius gets a lot of his ideas from Origen. So Constantine is going to be forced to intervene in this conflict, right? He is just, by the time he calls this big council that we're going to talk about, at the time he calls this council, he's just defeated Licentius. He's on his way to the Holy Land so he can go to the shrines in Jerusalem and kind of pay his respects. Maybe he may be baptized there at this time. And then on his way, he hears about this massive problem that's happening inside of Christianity. And Constantine had probably viewed Christianity as this unifying, this new force that's going to unify my empire. Paganism is dying out, but I can take Christianity and I can use that to unify my empire and kind of hold it together, give it a religious structure. And this is going to mean that any sort of dissent is going to be something he's going to have to deal with. And so he calls a council. And this is going to be Nicaea. Now, before this goes on, Eusebius sends his religious advisor, a bishop from Spain called Hosius, out. And Hosius sides with Alexander against Arius. And by the time we get to Nicaea, you have about 220 bishops. Constantine himself is present, presiding. There he is in the middle of the icon, right there. He's the one who calls it. And Constantine himself, probably with Hosius kind of proposing this to him, proposes the strongly worded homoousios. Christ is the same substance as the Father. All right? And despite the discord leading up to this, only two bishops out of the 220 don't sign the creed. Right? Did I say only two bishops sign the creed? That's wrong. That's the other way around. 118 bishops signed the creed. And the two who don't sign the creed are Libyan bishops. And they're probably more not signing the creed because the Council of Nicaea assigns Libya to the See of Alexandria as their metropolitan kind of bishop. And they didn't want that. So they did it for more political or ecclesiastical reasons than for any sort of Christological controversy that was going on. And so you might wonder, well, if there's all this controversy, why they do this? Well, one of the reasons is Constantine's pretty much forcing them. If you're there with Constantine and you're going to go against him, probably not a good idea. And they agree that, you know, they can, the same substance thing, I can just interpret that mystically or out, you know, any kind of way that I want. But Arius refuses to recant and he's exiled. Now, eventually he's going to be brought back in. But now after Nicaea, this might seem like it ends it, right? Nicaea comes, we've got the same substance, that kind of takes care of things, but it doesn't. Until 381, until the next great council, the Council of Constantine, we're still going to be dealing with this for the next almost 60 years. And there are going to be three phases to this. So if we can go to the next slide. Three phases. Here they are, broken down according to the reign of the emperors. Next slide. Look at the conflict here. Even though the likes of the Eusebiuses had signed the creed, I mean, they had to be happy about it. And Eusebius of Nicomedia especially is going to start working to overturn or at least undo what Nicaea had done. He's going to do this by overthrowing his three most powerful opponents. The bishop of Antioch, he makes his job pretty easy because he insults Constantine's mother. Never a good thing to do, so he was easy to get rid of. Now, Athanasius is going to prove much, much harder to do and get rid of, but eventually, because of some of Athanasius's actions, remember against that rigorous party that had developed in Egypt, that controversy is still going on in Alexandria. How are we going to allow the lax back in the church? Athanasius is the bishop of Alexandria after Alexander, the old bishop of Alexandria, dies. It's kind of harsh with them. And they kind of complain to Constantine, and this kind of gets the ball rolling. And in the midst of this controversy about how Athanasius handled these rigorous Christians, he threatens to cut off the grain supply to Constantinople, which is pretty big deal since most of Constantinople's food came from Alexandria. So he was gone pretty quickly. He was exiled to Trier in France. And then there's this other bishop, Marcellus, who writes a lot of anti-Arian pamphlets, he's gotten rid of. And then Constantine dies. But before he's died, Eusebius of Nicomedia has become the guy. He's now not just Eusebius of Nicomedia, he's the bishop of Constantinople, and he's actually the one who baptizes Constantine before he dies. So, next phase. Alright, so when Constantine dies, Athanasius and Marcellus attempt to return, but they're not allowed to. Constantine's son is even more influenced by Eusebius of Constantinople than his father was, and they're forced to go back to the west, but they're welcomed by the bishop of Rome. Bishop of Rome accepts them, welcomes them. He agrees that they're orthodox. And now, and then Eusebius dies, the Arians are left without a leader, and there's this, and Constantine's son, Constantius, calls a council and says, we're going to figure this out again. And this is going to be the Council of Sardica, which is in Sofia in Bulgaria. And you have all these political problems that are kind of keeping discord from arising. So the empire is split east and west. So even though Constantius calls the council, he has to deal with his brother, who's the emperor of the west. They don't get along. So the Council of Sardica produces two kind of opposing documents, and it's only under intense political pressure that these bishops are going to get together and compromise. And the compromise is that Athanasius gets to go back to Alexandria, but Marcellus doesn't. So that's kind of the compromise that they work out. And this is going to lead to the longest period of Athanasius being in Alexandria in his entire time that he's there. But unfortunately, more political problems develop. A rebel kills Constantius' brother. Constantius then kills the rebel, and he becomes the sole emperor of all the Roman Empire again. And in this battle that's going on, the Arians are the big supporter of Constantius. And so he favors them more and more. And this leads to the rise of radical Arians. Radical Arians who don't even want to use the substance, the term homoousios, which means similar substance. They don't want to say anything. They want to say he's dissimilar. Christ is dissimilar to the Father. So, and what this is going to do is really lead to moderation. So as the Arians become more and more radical, this leads moderates who had kind of been like, I don't know where I really fall on this issue, really into the camp of the Orthodox and conservatives. And a radical Arian becomes the bishop of Constantinople. And you're going to have the emperor really seeking for some sort of way of unifying these two very, very opposing camps. And he thinks the way to do it is going to be by accepting Arianism, because he views Arianism as a broader kind of field that's going to cover everything. Right? If I have an Arian creed, well, you can be like or dislike. It really doesn't matter. And he doesn't understand the seriousness of this issue, because the church is going to refuse to accept Arianism. And it's only at this point, when this doesn't work, that you have a lot of serious thinking being done by the Orthodox. And especially this is going to be, next slide, the third phase is going to be done by the Cappadocian fathers. And there are going to be a lot of other problems in this really thinking through that this period of the Arian controversy is going to bring about. You're going to have divinity of the Holy Spirit. Is it divinity? What's the essence and the hypostasis look like? How is it three? It's three in one. And then you have the rise of Apollinarianism, which is going to be extreme anti-Arianism. So you have a heresy on the other side. And the Cappadocian fathers, these are going to be guys like Basil of Caesarea, the son of Gregory of Nazianzus, and Gregory of Nursia, I think, are the guys. And eventually, the last of the Arian emperors, Valens, is going to die at the hands of the Goths at another battle at Adrianople in 378. And then Theodosius, the Western emperor, is going to come to power. And he's going to call a new council, the Council of Constantinople. And this is going to reaffirm Nicaea. It's going to make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. And it's going to condemn both Apollinarianism and Macedonianism. All right, next slide. All right, it doesn't end here. As this goes on, we have new problems that develop. Now, these aren't going to be all the where Christ is fully God or fully man, but it's going to be how does the God-man, him being combined, how is that going to be understood? How are we going to talk about this? And there are two schools that are going to be rivals in this. And these are going to be Alexandria, all right? And their Alexandrian theology stresses the oneness of the nature of God. This is going to be anti-Arian in a lot of ways. And the analogy that's usually used is like a jar with a mixture of water and wine perfectly mixed. All right? One thing. And then you have Antioch, which says that they're completely separate. And this is like a jar containing water and oil. All right? So this is the analogy that's used. Next slide. All right, here's another slide. So you can see that Nestorianism is going to come out of the Council of Constantinople, and Monophysitism is going to contradict this. And then we're going to have two more councils that it takes to undo or figure all this out. Next slide. And here's the Chalcedonian box. This kind of gives you an idea of how it all works. So the Council of Nicaea condemns Arianism, says that Christ is fully God. Council of Constantinople says that Christ is fully man. I mean, it's man. That's the anti-Apollinarianism. And then you have Ephesus, which condemns Nestorianism, says that Christ is one person. And then the Council of Chalcedon is going to condemn Monophysitism, that says that there are two natures within this one person. Okay, next slide. All right, now there are a lot of non-theological issues that are in the background of these heresies. All right, a lot of non-theological issues. And it's going to revolve around the political struggles between Alexandria and Antioch. They're not friends, typically. In a lot of ways. Even how they interpret the Bible is radically different. Alexandria uses an allegorical interpretation of Scripture. Antioch favors a much more literal interpretation of Scripture. So even their ways that they view and interpret Scriptures are very different. And you have this new see of Constantinople that develops, and this is going to threaten really the balance of power between Alexandria and Antioch, and they're going to seek to try and control it. One of the things that goes on is three times after 381, the bishops of Alexandria brought about the downfall of the bishop of Constantinople. They had him deposed through political kind of underworkings behind the scenes, had him kicked out. So they're very, very politically crafty. All right, next slide. So these are kind of the non-theological issues. Now, Nestorius is a monk from Antioch. He's a very, very good preacher. He becomes appointed the bishop of Constantinople. And one of the first things he does is he attacks this kind of title, Theotokos, which means God-bearer, that had been applied to Mary. He says, you can't say that unless you say also that Mary was man-bearer, right? This two-nature thing that goes on. And this really gets Cyril, the bishop of Alexandria, and also the bishop of Jerusalem, really worked up. And they are going to condemn Nestorius. They're going to say that his ideas are wrong. But he's very popular with the emperor. And they call a council, the Council of Ephesus, which meets in 381. No, not 381, but 431. 431. And they condemn Nestorius, Cyril, and the bishop of Jerusalem do, and the bishop of Rome. And at the same time, Nestorius and his backers condemn everyone else. So you have these two kind of rival things, and the emperor is uncertain what to do. And eventually a compromise is worked out, like always happens. Nestorius voluntarily goes into exile. And Cyril, the bishop of Alexandria, had to find a formulary of peace, which is just like an idea, a statement of orthodoxy that really upholds Antioch's view of the two natures. So, but this peace is only going to be temporary, unfortunately. Next slide. And this is going to lead to a new round of heresy, which is going to be the Monophysites. And this is going to be a new bishop of Alexandria, a guy by the name of Dioscorus, who's going to be an extreme Monophysite. And he, along with the eunuch and chief minister of the emperor, a guy by the name of Chrysophius, and Chrysophius' godfather, Eutychus, determined to overthrow the bishop of Constantinople and to overthrow the Council of Ephesus. So to undo it. And they call another council, the Second Council of Ephesus. And the Pope condemns their views of the one nature of Christ, sends his famous tome, Leo's tome. But no one's able to stop it because the Monophysites are in control. And Dioscorus and his allies have Flavian arrested and eventually kill him. And all the leading Nestorians are deposed. And Monophysitism seems completely in control. Completely in control. And unfortunately, though, for them, anyway, fortunately for us, next slide, this is going to have three problems for the Monophysites. Leo refuses to go along with this, and he's going to be a big voice saying, you're wrong. And this is really going to be one of the big reasons, we'll talk about this next week too, why the papacy really ascends in power, because just about every time on all these heretical issues, Rome is always on the side of orthodoxy. And where a number of other bishops and a number of other sees aren't, Rome is traditionally always right on as far as the Christological heresies go. And this is really going to add a lot of weight to Rome's claims of importance. Also, the new bishop of Constantinople refuses to go along with the bishop of Alexandria and be his puppet. And then there's a changing political situation. The emperor Theodosius II dies. His counselor is arrested by the emperor's sister, who's not a Monophysite in any way, very anti-Monophysite, has him arrested and killed, and she calls a council. And this is going to be the Council of Chalcedon. That's the last slide that we're going to deal with. And this is going to reverse all the decisions of the Second Council of Ephesus. Leo's Tomes approved. Nestorius is still condemned as a heretic, although a lot of his ideas, as they continue to develop, fall more in line with Chalcedon. And this is what it says. This is kind of Chalcedon in a nutshell. Christ is a perfect God and perfect man, co-substantial with the Father in His Godhead and with us in His manhood, made known in two natures without confusion, change, division, or separation. The difference between the natures is in no way abolished by the union, and the properties of each nature are preserved intact, and both come together to form one person and one hypostasis. So that's kind of the end all be all of this. But this doesn't end the problem of Nestorianism and Monophysitism. These churches are going to be massive, massive institutions, and they're going to continue to, especially the Eastern Empire. The Western Empire is not going to be troubled by them, but in the East, these are going to be big-time problems for the church continuing for hundreds of years, all the way up until really the Muslim invasions wipe out the Nestorian and Monophysite churches as far as the Eastern Empire is concerned. But they still exist. Coptic Christians are still Monophysites. Ethiopian Christians are still Monophysites. And the Armenian Christians, until the Turks eliminated them in the First World War, were Nestorians. And Nestorian Christianity, as you can see from this map over here, is going to spread all the way to China and all the way to Japan. So by the 600s, you're going to have Nestorian churches in China and Japan. And the Nestorian church in Japan is going to last all the way up until the 1600s, when it's wiped out by the Japanese. And probably the greatest persecution, organized persecution of Christians ever. And the Monophysite church is going to exist in Arabia and in the eastern part of the empire, especially in Ethiopia, in Egypt, and in southern Arabia. There are going to be large populations of Monophysites. These ideas are not going to go away. And they're still around today. So these are still things that we deal with in a lot of ways. All right. Any questions? I know I'm right at time right now. But that was a... Yes? It's Christ is not the two natures. It's like Christ's humanity is lost in His divinity. So the mind, the human mind of Christ doesn't really exist. It's a divine mind. So he's not fully human. So if he's not fully human in a lot of ways, then he can't kind of be a propitiation for us. He can't be a man. And so Jesus is almost like play acting in the temptation. It's not really a human mind that's having the struggle with temptations. It's a divine mind. So the idea that he's really tempted is not there. Any other questions? Okay. Well, I'll pray, and then we can go. All right. Father, thank you for the time that we've had to come and study about your church. We know that, thankfully, we don't have to go back in a lot of ways and deal with these conflicts again. We've had you, in your grace and knowledge, have given us great thinkers who have come before us and people that have solved these problems for us, and we are grateful that we can sit and learn from them so that we don't have to solve these same problems from the very beginning again. We pray that you will use us and use our study in a way that honors and glorifies you. In your name we pray. Amen.